Hello, hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Crime with Holly. You guys, if you are not following me on social media, you likely missed what I got to do last weekend. Last weekend was CrimeCon here in Las Vegas, and I finally got to attend my very first CrimeCon. Let me just say, it was amazing. If you've been on the fence about attending, I highly, highly, highly recommend it. Not only do you get the opportunity to meet your favorite faces of true crime, but the sessions they were offering are incredible. I got to listen to David Middleman, the founder of Othram Labs, twice, and that man is freaking brilliant, and he has a heart of gold. His motto is that unsolved crime is a choice. And listening to him speak about Othram and all that they are doing was so fascinating and mind-blowing. And I have to be honest, a little bit of it, the science stuff, was a little over my head, but it was amazing nonetheless. He and his wife are really changing the world. They are making a huge, huge difference. They are just two fantastic people who want to help. I also got to listen to Chris Hansen talk about the dangers of Roblox, and you guys, that was very eye-opening. If you're interested in watching all of the sessions from CrimeCon, you can do so on crimehq.com. It's just $6.99 a month or $50 for the year, but getting to watch this Chris Hansen's Roblox talk is well worth it if you have kids that play that game or want to play that game. It is horrific what is happening on Roblox, and it was things that I didn't even know were possible. I also got to finally meet the one and only Angeline Hartman from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. As many of you know, Angeline has been a personal friend of mine for years. She has been someone I could text in the middle of night for resources when I have friends reaching out concerned about their kids. She's someone who has been on the show before and is just such a beautiful and wonderful person. I am so freaking sad that as we were squealing and hugging each other, so excited to actually finally be meeting in person after all these years of texting and phone calls and FaceTime, we actually completely forgot to get a photo, and I am so kicking myself for that. I guess I will just have to get that photo next year at CrimeCon in Orlando. I am really hoping that I am able to attend CrimeCon next year in Orlando, but let me just say, as a military spouse, Lord knows I cannot plan anything that far in advance, so for now, I am just crossing my fingers that I can make it happen. I also got to meet several of you guys, which was so freaking cool. You guys have no idea how much it meant to me that you came up, you said hi, you gave me big hugs. I love you guys so incredibly much. I attended CrimeCon this year with a longtime listener turned friend named Lynn. Lynn really helped me get outside of my comfort zone all weekend long. She was the best hype girl, forcing me to tell everyone who I was and what my podcast is. She introduced me to Gabby Petito's mom and told her about my ethical coverage that I did on TikTok about Gabby, which her mom, Nicole Schmidt, was very appreciative of. I really struggle with something called imposter syndrome, and Lynn was the boost that I needed over the weekend, and I just want to give her this little shout out because I know she's going to hear this, so thank you, Lynn. I know I've told you before, but I really, really appreciated our time together. I could gush about CrimeCon forever, but I know that's not why everyone is here today. But before we get into the details of today's case, I do have a Patreon shout out to give. While I was sitting in a session at CrimeCon, I got the notification that the lovely Laurel joined the Patreon family. Thank you so much, Laurel. Like I said, I was sitting in a CrimeCon session and it made me smile so big that you signed up. It actually reaffirmed my mission and purpose behind not only attending CrimeCon, but for my podcast as a whole. I am so passionate about what I do, and I love that you guys are so supportive of me, and it really fuels my fire to continue. So thank you so much. If you want to be like Laurel and get rid of all those pesky ads, you can sign up at www.patreon.com/crimewithholly. And for just $2 a month, you can listen to every single episode ad-free. Okay, so with all of that said and done, let's get down to business. Today's episode is going to talk about breakup violence. This is a topic that isn't talked about enough, in my opinion. We hear about domestic violence. We sometimes hear about teen dating violence, and this kind of goes hand in hand with dating violence. But we don't hear about breakup violence, which is actually more common than anyone knows. And breakup violence is exactly what it sounds like. It's violence that happens after a breakup. Today's episode is about a beautiful young 18-year-old whose life was just beginning. She had goals, dreams, and many ambitions. And all of that would end abruptly after breaking up with her longtime boyfriend. This is the tragic story of Lauren Astley. Lauren Dunn Astley was born on April 1st, 1993 in Boston, Massachusetts, to her parents Mary and Malcolm. Though she was born in Boston, Lauren was raised in the town of Wayland, Massachusetts, which is a quiet, picturesque community located west of Boston. And honestly, I had never heard of Wayland before researching this case, so of course I had to look it up. And it looks exactly like the kind of town you'd imagine in a movie. Tree-lined streets, gorgeous homes, vibrant fall colors everywhere in the fall, and just one of those peaceful New England towns that feels safe. The kind of place where you'd want to raise a family and everyone knows each other. Lauren was an only child, and although her parents eventually divorced, she was surrounded by love her entire life. Mary and Malcolm co-parented incredibly well, and by all accounts, Lauren was their everything. Growing up, Lauren was involved in nearly everything that she could get into. She was an accomplished tennis player, a member of an a cappella group called the Muses, and let me just say, Lauren had an incredible voice. I watched videos of Lauren singing during my research, and she was genuinely so incredibly talented. In fact, she was so talented enough to land the leading role in Annie with the Weston Friendly Society of Performing Arts. She also played the French horn and performed with the Metro West Youth Symphony Orchestra. She volunteered as a YMCA camp counselor, worked at a small clothing boutique called Shop 344 because she loved fashion. And she was heavily involved in her church where she sang in the children's choir and participated in youth group activities. And if all of that somehow wasn't enough, Lauren also volunteered her time traveling to New Orleans to help rebuild after Hurricane Katrina. Lauren was the definition of driven, the kind of person who constantly poured herself into the people and the world around her. Standing at just 5 feet tall, Lauren truly embodied the phrase, small but mighty. She was unstoppable. She had this energy about her that made it feel like she was destined to leave a mark on the world. And honestly, I have no doubt that had her life not been stolen from her, she would have gone on to do incredible, meaningful things. By the time Lauren reached Wayland High School, it probably won't surprise you to hear that she was involved in just about everything there as well. She was a great student, active in school activities, and had built a close-knit group of friends who absolutely adored her. Her friends described Lauren as fearless and sassy, the kind of girl who would only put $5 worth of gas in her car because she'd rather save the rest of her money for a cute new pair of shoes or her favorite Starbucks drink. She was funny, smart, outgoing, and fiercely loyal to the people she loved. Lauren had a big personality and wasn't someone who blended into the background. In fact, she was known as a bit of a trendsetter among her peers. And somewhere along the way, Lauren started dating Nathaniel Fujita, the star wide receiver for the Wayland High School football team. I believe the two started dating during their sophomore year. Nathan was Lauren's first serious boyfriend, and to most people, they looked like the picture-perfect couple. They were attractive, popular, successful, and seemed to have their entire futures mapped out in front of them. Nathan was handsome, well-liked, and quiet by nature. His friends described him as funny, friendly, and genuinely kind-hearted. He was the type of person many people looked up to. And from the outside, it really seemed like he had it all. Together, Lauren and Nathan were what people would call the it couple. But as we all know, appearances can be incredibly deceiving. Because while things may have looked picture perfect from the outside, behind closed doors, their relationship wasn't always smooth sailing. The two argued a lot. They broke up, then got back together, then broke up again, then got back together again. And honestly, if you're thinking that sounds pretty typical for a teenage relationship, you'd be right. I don't know about you guys, but when I was in high school, I'd be convinced a relationship was over forever on a Tuesday and back together with my boyfriend by Friday. Teenage relationships can be dramatic, emotional, and so complicated. And for a long time, that seemed to be exactly what was happening with Lauren and Nathan. In fact, many people say that the first couple years of their relationship was actually pretty good, but as they got older and started thinking about their futures, cracks began to form. Maybe it was the pressure of graduation approaching, maybe it was the realization that they were about to head in different directions, or maybe they were simply growing into different people. Whatever the reason, Lauren seemed to be reaching a point where she was starting to ask herself what she really wanted. And the answer was becoming clear. As graduation got closer and the arguments continued, Lauren began realizing that this relationship might not be part of the future she envisioned for herself. Her friends were supportive of that realization. They liked Nathan to an extent and thought that he was a good enough person, but they could also see that this relationship wasn't necessarily the right fit for Lauren anymore. Then on April 1st, 2011, Lauren's 18th birthday, she made the decision and she broke up with Nathan. And this time it was supposed to be for good. Lauren was preparing to attend Elon University in North Carolina that fall, while Nathan was headed to Trinity College in Connecticut on a football scholarship. Their lives were moving in different directions, and after years of ups and downs, it felt like the right time to finally let it all go. Lauren was excited for what was ahead. She was ready for college, ready for new experiences, ready to meet new people, build new friendships, and start the next chapter of her life. For Lauren, the breakup brought a sense of relief, but for Nathan, it was a very different story. He took the breakup incredibly hard. And honestly, that's not unusual either. First breakups can feel absolutely devastating, especially when you've spent years imagining your future with someone. What should have been one of the most exciting times in Nathan's life was suddenly overshadowed by loss. He was about to achieve a lifelong dream of playing football at the collegiate level, a dream that he had worked towards for years. But instead of feeling excitement about the future, friends and family began noticing a change in him. Nathan wasn't himself. He seemed withdrawn, distant, deeply upset, and often angry. He stopped wanting to do anything, stopped hanging out with any of his friends, and he began drinking and smoking weed. He was clearly in a downward spiral of depression, and it had gotten so bad that his mom actually had taken him to a psychiatrist for help. She also went to Lauren's work secretly to ask her to please talk to her son and see if she can cheer him up somehow. Unfortunately, no one could have imagined where those emotions would ultimately lead. Graduation had finally arrived, and like most teenagers standing on the edge of adulthood, Lauren and her friends were ready to celebrate. Summer was beginning, college was right around the corner, and it felt like the start of an entirely new point in their lives. To kick things off, Lauren and her girlfriends planned a huge graduation party. Around 150 students showed up. There was music, dancing, laughter, and the whole thing took place under one of those massive party tents that people rent for special events. It was supposed to be one of those unforgettable nights that you look back on years later. All of Lauren's closest friends were there, and so was Nathan. Throughout the night, Nathan repeatedly approached Lauren, asking, really more like begging her, to talk to him. But Lauren wasn't interested. She told him over and over and over again to leave her alone, to back off, and that she didn't want to talk to him. This was supposed to be a night of celebration and fun, but Nathan couldn't seem to accept that the relationship was over. In fact, Lauren was so frustrated by his behavior that she even told her mother what was happening. She said Nathan wouldn't leave her alone, that he was harassing her, and that he didn't want her dancing with anyone. As the night went on and Lauren continued refusing to engage with him, Nathan became increasingly upset. At one point, he punched one of the tent poles supporting the party tent, and he hit it so hard that he actually damaged the structure. The tent began to buckle, and partygoers had to rush over to physically hold it up to keep it from collapsing on everyone underneath. After that, Nathan was asked to leave, and while he eventually did, the damage had already been done. What should have been one of the happiest nights of Lauren's life had been overshadowed by drama and tension. And unfortunately, things were only about to get worse. Fast forward 1 month later, July 3rd, 2011. At 9:45 in the morning, surveillance cameras captured Lauren arriving at the local mall for her shift at the clothing boutique where she worked. Nearly 9 hours later, at 6:45 p.m., cameras recorded her leaving the mall while talking on her cell phone. No one knew at that time, but those images would become the last known footage of Lauren alive. That evening, Lauren had made plans to meet up with a group of her girlfriends, but she never showed up. At first, friends just figured that she was running late, then the calls started going unanswered. The text messages weren't being returned. And almost immediately, alarm bells started going off, because this wasn't like Lauren. Her friends were incredibly close. They were the type of group that always knew where everyone was and what they were going to be doing. For Lauren to suddenly disappear, without a word, without a peep, that was completely out of character. Her father, Malcolm, became concerned almost immediately as well. Lauren had planned to stop by the house after work before heading out with her friends, and Lauren was the kind of kid who stayed in constant contact with her parents. If plans changed, she called. If she was running late, she called. If she was going somewhere unexpected, she called. So when she didn't come home and wasn't answering her phone, Malcolm knew something wasn't right. This was so unlike Lauren that something had to be wrong. Unable to shake that feeling, Malcolm contacted the Wayland Police Department and reported Lauren missing. News spread quickly through the community, and her friends were consumed with worry. And I do want to take a moment here just to give credit where credit is due. The Wayland Police Department acted fast. They didn't dismiss Lauren as a teenager who had simply decided to stay out late. They didn't wait for days on end to go by before taking action. They immediately began looking for her, which is exactly what you want to see in a missing persons case. Then there was a heartbreaking discovery. One of her friends located her car in the parking lot at Wayland Town Beach. The windows were rolled down, her purse was still inside, her laptop was inside as well. but Lauren was nowhere to be found. When Malcolm learned that her car had been found, he rushed to the beach along with the rest of Lauren's friend group. And the next part breaks my heart. It chokes me up just thinking about it and just saying it for you guys. But when Malcolm got to the beach, he ran straight toward the water. He was yelling Lauren's name, calling out for her, hoping that she would answer back, hoping maybe that she was just injured somewhere or that she had some sort of accident, and that if he could just find her quickly enough, he could still help her. But Lauren wasn't there, and at this point, it was already too late. Standing there looking at her abandoned car, Malcolm's mind began going to places no parent ever wants their mind to go to when it comes to their kids. He knew Lauren would never voluntarily leave her purse, her laptop, and her car sitting unlocked with the windows down. Something had happened, and that question was what? Lauren's friends and family stayed at the beach throughout the entire night, hoping and praying that she would somehow return. But of course, she never did. Meanwhile, investigators began interviewing Lauren's friends, trying to piece together where she might have gone and who she might have been with. And naturally, one of the names that came up was Nathan Fujita. But at that point, Lauren's friends couldn't imagine Nathan hurting her. Even after the breakup, they believed that he still deeply loved Lauren. The idea that he could be responsible for her disappearance seemed impossible. While officers continued searching the beach and gathering information from Lauren's friends and family, other investigators headed to the home of Nathan Fujita. At that point, Nathan was still being viewed as Lauren's ex-boyfriend, someone investigators needed to speak with, but not necessarily their prime suspect. When questioned, Nathan admitted that he had seen Lauren after she got off of work that evening. According to him, Lauren had stopped by his house for about 5 minutes. They had an awkward conversation, and then she left. His parents backed up part of his story, saying that Nathan had been home that evening, although neither of his parents had actually been there with him. For the moment, it seemed like Nathan had a reasonably-ish solid explanation. But by the next morning, everything would change. On the morning of July 4th, 2011, a cyclist was out for a ride when he passed a marshy area and noticed something that immediately caught his attention. As he got closer, he realized he wasn't looking at debris. He was looking at a body. 18-year-old Lauren Astley had been found. Her body was discovered in a marsh just 5 miles from her home. And what investigators found was absolutely horrific. Wrapped around her neck and tangled in her hair was a bungee cord. Medical examiners would later describe a jagged, gaping wound across her throat. There was no longer any question about whether Lauren was missing. Now investigators were working a homicide. Almost immediately, police returned to the Fujita residence. This time, Nathan's father answered the door. And when investigators asked where Nathan was, his father said he had no idea. That answer only heightened their suspicion. Investigators quickly secured a search warrant and began processing the home. What they found inside would dramatically change the direction of the case. Starting in the garage, investigators located what appeared to be a bloodstain on the concrete floor. A presumptive test was conducted on scene and came back positive for blood. As the search continued, more blood evidence was discovered throughout the house, including in the kitchen, in the sink, and on a door handle. And then there was another discovery. Investigators located bungee cords in the garage that were consistent with the cord found wrapped around Lauren's neck. In the basement, they found a black duffel bag containing a pair of wet tennis shoes covered in mud. And inside Nathan's bedroom, investigators discovered something even more incriminating. Hidden in an attic crawl space were blood-soaked shoes and clothing. When the evidence was sent to the crime lab, the results were devastating. The blood found throughout the house, as well as on the shoes and clothing, belonged to Lauren. At that point, investigators weren't just looking for answers, they were looking for Nathan Fujita. In the early morning hours of July 5th, 2011, Nathan was located, arrested, and charged with Lauren Astley's murder. When the word got out that Nathan had murdered Lauren, everyone who knew him was completely shocked. This was Nathan Fujita, the quiet football star, the polite kid the young man described as kind-hearted and respectful. The idea that he could commit such a brutal and violent crime seemed impossible to many people. But the evidence investigators were uncovering painted a very different picture. Now, authorities needed to determine exactly what had happened inside that house. As detectives worked to build a timeline, they returned to the surveillance footage from the mall. Remember, the last video of Lauren alive showed her leaving work while talking on her cell phone. Investigators were able to confirm that the person on the other end of that call was Nathan. And based on the evidence they gathered, they believe Lauren agreed to stop by Nathan's house so that the two could talk. It was likely a conversation that she thought was just going to last a few minutes. Instead, it would be the last decision that she ever made. Investigators believe Lauren never told anyone that she was going to Nathan's house because she didn't view it as a big deal. As far as they could tell, she planned to stop by briefly, have a conversation with her ex-boyfriend, and then continue on with her plans that she had already made for the evening. At 7:05 p.m., Lauren sent what would become her final text message. The message was to Nathan and said, "Here." From there, they believed he lured Lauren into the garage and attacked her, first violently strangling her with a bungee cord before cutting her throat. Authorities believe Nathan got into Lauren's car and drove it roughly a quarter mile away to the Town Beach parking lot. Once there, he abandoned her car, tossed her keys into a nearby storm drain, and ran back home. Nathan then loaded Lauren's body into his own car and drove to a secluded marshy area where he attempted to conceal her body in the vegetation. Afterwards, he simply drove home. And perhaps one of the most chilling details came from a witness who personally knew Nathan. The witness reported seeing him driving home that evening with his shirt off, the windows down, and music blasting from the car. Investigators believe that once Nathan returned home, he cleaned up, hid the evidence, and attempted to carry on as though nothing had happened. Meanwhile, Lauren's friends were desperately searching for her. When some of them contacted Nathan asking whether he had seen Lauren, his response struck many of them as odd. According to them, he was rude and dismissive, telling them, quote, "This is the last place Lauren would be." But investigators would later conclude that Nathan knew exactly where Lauren was. On August 23, 2011, 18-year-old Nathan Fujita appeared in court for a plea hearing. He pleaded not guilty to first-degree murder, as well as charges of assault and battery and assault and battery with a dangerous weapon. As the case moved toward trial, additional details began emerging about Nathan, his history with Lauren, and behavior that prosecutors believed painted a troubling picture. One of the most shocking revelations involved an incident that occurred 2 years before Lauren's murder. At the time, Lauren and Nathan were going through one of their many breakups. In June 2009, both attended a party hosted by another Wayland High School student. During the party, a classmate kissed Lauren while they were dancing. When Nathan learned about it, witnesses said he became enraged. He allegedly tried to attack the other young man and had to be physically restrained by friends. Eventually, Nathan was forced to leave the party, but according to witnesses, the incident didn't end there. Standing at the end of the driveway, Nathan allegedly screamed threats at the other guy, saying that he would slit his throat, smash his head with a rock, and urinate on him. Another troubling detail involved the hours immediately after the murder. Evidence showed that Nathan reached out to one of his cousins and asked if she wanted to hang out. And we now know that invitation was sent after prosecutors believe Lauren had already been killed. For reasons unrelated to the case, the cousin was unable to meet up with him. But the following day, after Lauren's body had been discovered, she spoke with Nathan. And during that conversation, he came dangerously close to admitting what he had done. When discussing how Lauren's car ended up at the beach, Nathan reportedly responded with three chilling words: "It was me." Nathan's trial began on February 13th, 2013, and Nathan's defense was trying to go for a not guilty for reason of insanity defense. Over the next 3 weeks, jurors would hear testimony detailing the final days of Lauren's life and the evidence prosecutors believed proved Nathan had planned her murder. The trial was emotional for everyone involved. Every day, the courtroom was packed with friends, family members, and community members who had watched these two teenagers grow up. On one side sat Lauren's parents, Mary and Malcolm, forced to listen to the heartbreaking details about their daughter's final moments. On the other sat Nathan's parents, often with their heads lowered as their son sat in front of them at the defendant's table. Prosecutor Lisa McGovern argued that this was not a crime committed in the heat of passion. Nathan had deliberately planned the murder. She pointed to evidence showing that while Lauren was working her shift at the mall, Nathan called her three separate times. And prosecutors argue that those calls were part of his effort to convince Lauren to come to the house that evening. Lauren had reportedly told coworkers that she planned to stop by Nathan's house after work before continuing with the rest of her night. Prosecutors argue that Lauren didn't go to Nathan's house because she wanted to rekindle the relationship. She went because she cared. As I mentioned earlier, Nathan's mother had actually stopped by Lauren's workplace and asked her to talk to Nathan. His family was deeply concerned about him. Friends would later testify that after graduation, Nathan had essentially disappeared. He stopped calling people, he stopped responding to texts, he stopped hanging out with friends altogether. Several witnesses described him as withdrawing from everyone around him. Family members testified that Nathan rarely left the house, and the young man who had once been so excited about college football appeared to be spiraling into a deep depression, turning to drugs and alcohol as a way to cope. And Lauren, being Lauren, had a difficult time turning her back on someone she cared about. Though they were broken up, she still cared for Nathan and she wanted the best for him. Prosecutors believe that she agreed to meet with Nathan because she was worried about him, because she wanted to help, because she had a big heart. And instead of just talking, Nathan got Lauren to get out of her car, go into the garage with him, and that's when he attacked her. He beat her before strangling her and cutting her throat. It was also revealed that Lauren tried to fight back and had clear defensive wounds to her body. And even Nathan's cousin testified that she noticed scratches on his arms after the murder. The defense, however, presented a very different explanation for what had happened. Their argument centered around the claim that Nathan experienced what they described as a fleeting psychotic episode. You'll probably remember that after the breakup, Nathan's mother became so concerned about his mental state that she took him to see a psychiatrist. There, Nathan was diagnosed with major clinical depression. His attorneys argued that this wasn't simply a teenager feeling sad after a breakup. According to the defense, Nathan was experiencing a severe depressive episode that had been worsening for months. The psychiatrist reportedly recommended both antidepressants and therapy, but Nathan refused treatment. And as the days went on, he became more isolated and was falling deeper into depression. One of the defense's key witnesses was forensic psychiatrist Dr. Wade Myers. Dr. Myers testified that during his evaluation after the murder, Nathan described walking into the garage with Lauren before grabbing the bungee cord and strangling her. But according to Nathan, his body was carrying out the actions while his mind was disconnected from what was happening. Dr. Myers told the jury that Nathan was suffering from a psychotic episode and remained in that state while reportedly attacking Lauren. The defense argued that Nathan had no emotional connection to the violence he was inflicting. They also suggested that years of playing football and potential head trauma may have contributed to his deteriorating mental health, and they also said that schizophrenia ran in his family. But ultimately, the defense's position was that severe depression and psychosis, not premeditation, were responsible for Lauren's death. The prosecution wasn't buying it. And frankly, they believe Nathan's actions after the murder told a very different story. During closing arguments, prosecutors focused heavily on what happened after Lauren was killed. They reminded jurors that Nathan drove Lauren's car to the beach parking lot. He threw her keys into a storm drain. He transported and concealed her body in the marsh. He returned home. He changed his clothes. He cleaned up blood evidence. He hid blood-soaked clothing in the attic. And he concealed muddy shoes inside a duffel bag. Those aren't actions of someone completely disconnected from reality, prosecutors argued. Those are the actions of someone trying to avoid getting caught, someone who knew exactly what they had done. And ultimately, that's how the jury saw it too. On March 7th, 2013, after just a single day of deliberations, the jury returned its verdict. Nathan Fujita was found guilty on all charges. As the verdict was read, emotion flooded the courtroom. Sobs could be heard from both sides. On one side sat Nathan's family, devastated as their son was convicted of murder. On the other sat Lauren's family, grieving the daughter they would never get back. Two families, two completely different losses. Both changed forever by what happened on July 3rd, 2011. And then something happened that nobody in the courtroom expected. Honestly, even now, it's one of those moments that gets me emotional every time I think about it. After the verdict, Malcolm Astley, he stood up, he walked across the courtroom, and he embraced Nathan's parents. Just let that sink in for a moment. The father of a murdered daughter walked over and hugged the parents of the man who killed her. When later asked why he did it, Malcolm's answer was simple. He said he was sharing grief and wishing them comfort in the ongoing horror they were facing. I don't know about you guys, but I genuinely cannot imagine the strength that must have taken. Because while no one suffered the loss that Malcolm and Mary did, Malcolm recognized something many people would never be able to see in that moment. The Fujitas lost something too. Not in the same way, not even close, but they lost the son they thought they knew, the future they imagined for their family for years on end. And they would spend the rest of their lives carrying the weight of what he had done. I watched the footage of that moment, and I'll be honest, it made me cry. Talking about it now, my eyes are like all teared up because you can just see the pain written across every single face in that courtroom. While justice was served, it was not making anything better. His family lost their son. Her family lost their daughter. This was a lose-lose situation all the way around. And yet Malcolm, a father whose daughter had been violently taken from him, somehow found enough compassion to acknowledge the pain of another family. To me, that speaks volumes about the kind of man that Malcolm Astley is. Before sentencing, both Malcolm and Mary were given the opportunity to address the court. As you can imagine, their victim impact statement were heartbreaking, to say the least. Mary spoke about all of the milestones that she had stolen from her. The wedding that she will never attend, the birthdays that she will never celebrate with Lauren, the grandchildren that she will never meet. She spoke about not knowing whether she would ever truly live again without her daughter. And one statement in particular absolutely shattered me. Mary said that she would never again hear someone call her mom because Lauren was her only child and that was taken from her. And that reality is just impossible to comprehend. It gets me choked up just saying it. I know this is like super emotional, but it's so incredibly heartbreaking. I cannot imagine. In Malcolm's statement, he encouraged Nathan to use whatever talents and skills he possessed to help others while he's incarcerated. Malcolm called it a, quote, notable gift of atonement in Lauren's memory, end quote. But he also asked Nathan for something else, an apology. Because despite everything that had happened, Nathan had never truly said that he was sorry. At the time of sentencing, Massachusetts law required a mandatory sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole for first-degree murder, and that is exactly the sentence Nathan received. For years, that appeared to be the end of things, but then came a major change. In 2024, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court ruled that individuals who were under the age of 21 at the time of their crimes could not be sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. Because Nathan was only 18 years old when Lauren was murdered and 20 years old when he was sentenced, that ruling applied to him. His sentence was modified to life in prison with the possibility of parole after serving 15 years. Under that ruling, Nathan will now become eligible for parole in 2028. And I'll leave it to each of you to form your own opinion about that decision. What I want to focus on is Lauren, because while Nathan's actions took her life, they did not take away her impact. One thing I always admire is when families find a way to transform unimaginable pain into purpose. And that is exactly what Lauren's parents have done. They created the Lauren Dunn Astley Memorial Fund, a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting education and awareness surrounding healthy teen relationships and dating violence prevention. According to the organization's mission, they work to bring evidence-based, life-saving relationship education programs to young people. Over the years, Malcolm has traveled across the country sharing Lauren's story with students, educators, and communities in hopes of preventing another family from experiencing the same tragedy. They teach young people about warning signs, unhealthy relationship behaviors, breakup violence, and how to seek help when something doesn't feel right. One of the most powerful messages that Mary shares is something incredibly simple. Never go alone. Mary has spoken about how Lauren wasn't afraid of Nathan. She trusted him. And because she trusted him, she went to meet him by herself. Mary believes that if Lauren had brought a friend along that night, things may have turned out differently. Whether that's true or not, it's a message that has resonated with countless families. I'll include the link to the Lauren Dunn Astley Memorial Fund in the description of this episode. I was deeply moved by Lauren's story and by the work her parents continue to do, and I personally made a donation to support their mission. If you would like to donate as well, you can find the link in the episode description. And if you do donate, send me a screenshot on Instagram or in the Crime with Holly Facebook discussion group, and I will send you a Crime with Holly sticker as just a small thank you for supporting this family and the work that they are doing. I also want to take a moment to mention that the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children offers incredible resources for families, educators, and children on topics ranging from internet safety and personal safety to healthy relationships and recognizing warning signs and all of that. It's a resource that I highly recommend every parent familiarizes themselves with. Lauren's story is heartbreaking. It's the story of a bright, talented young woman who should have had decades of life ahead of her. But it's also the story of two parents who refused to let their daughter's legacy end with her murder. Instead, they chose to create change. They chose education. They chose awareness. And they chose to honor Lauren by fighting for a future where fewer families have to endure the pain they live with every single day. And to me, there is no greater way to honor a child's memory than that. Crimesters, that is all that I have for today's episode. Make sure that you are a part of my private Facebook group. You can find it by searching Crime with Holly Podcast Discussion Group. In there, I share all information and pictures pertaining to the cases that I cover, and I also encourage all members to share all things true crime. You can also find me on Instagram at CrimeaHolly, and if you would like more true crime content, you can find me on TikTok at crimewithholly.podcast. Please, if you haven't already, leave me a review on your preferred podcast platform. This not only tells me that you are enjoying the show, but it also helps others find the podcast as well. I appreciate you all so much for continuing to support me and to support the show. It truly means so much. All right, you guys, I will catch you next time. But in the meantime, you know what to do. Always remember to be aware and take care. Bye-bye.